Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the June 25th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Tuesdays, Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. On June 28th, 1914, 100 years ago, this Saturday, Austria's Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo. By the end of that summer, Europe would be engaged in a war that would last more than 4 years, topple four empires, produce the Russian Revolution, draw the boundaries of the modern Middle East, legitimize the Zionist colonization of Palestine, and make the United States the leading world power. It would also cost the lives of 10 million soldiers and 7 million civilians. In 1919, shortly after the war's conclusion, the great Irish poet, William Butler Yeats, looked upon the wreckage of Europe and composed his most famous poem, Second Coming. Here's how it began. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loose, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passion and intensity. End quote. Those opening lines of Yeats's poem are much on my mind these days as I contemplate the tsunami of violence that's washing across the planet a century after the war to end all wars. That's how they sold it. While avoiding the ideological potholes that tempt us to frame today's multitude of bloody conflicts as pitting good guys versus bad guys and part of an imperial American plan to create worldwide chaos. Although for sure the role of the United States in unleashing the tsunami has been, to borrow one of President Obama's favorite terms, indispensable. It's fair to say, as U.S. troops are once again on the ground in Iraq, that the majority of Americans are either unconscious of or unwilling to accept the primary responsibility of the United States for the human disasters that have been inflicted on the world in the aftermath of 9/11. Given the sorry state of our public school system's teaching of history and our collective hubris, it is probably a combination of both. This morning at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about this dilemma with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI agent and whistleblower regarding the events of 9/11 at that time. In 2002, Rowley was one of three women to share Time Magazine's Person of the Year Award and has since been a vocal critic of the U.S. foreign policy, and its military adventurism. Until then, let's look at some other related news. We'll start with the travels of John Kerry, our increasingly clueless Secretary of State. On his way to try and unsuccessfully persuade Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to open a Shia-dominated government to its Sunni rivals, a little late at this point, with the forces of the Islamic State of the Levant, or ISIL, less than an hour away from Baghdad, Kerry stopped off in Cairo to express his and President Obama's warm feelings for Egypt's new president, former General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. That el-Sisi is running what has become clearly the most oppressive regime in the region known for its oppressive regimes seemed lost on Kerry. He assured el-Sisi that the millions of U.S. military aid that had been frozen because of Egypt's grotesque human rights record, including the killing of 1,150 mostly unarmed protesters last year, would be released, quote, very soon, unquote. His visit came a day after an Egyptian court sentenced to death 182 Muslim Brotherhood members and their leader for their alleged role in a confrontation last year in which one police officer was killed, and a day before a Cairo court sent three Al Jazeera reporters to prison for terms ranging from 7 to 10 years for simply doing their job. Here was Kerry's reasoning for ending the freeze on aid and renewing U.S. support for Egypt and el-Sisi. Quote, he, meaning el-Sisi, gave me a strong sense of his commitment to make certain that the process he has put in place, a reevaluation of human rights legislation, a reevaluation of the judicial process, and other choices that are available are very much on his mind. That's Kerry. And he's only been in office for 10 days, but he indicated to me that we would work closely, as we will, and stay tuned to what he's going to try to implement over the course of these next days, weeks, and months, end quote. As Bloomberg News editorial pointed out, Kerry's statement was, quote, to put it politely, naive, since el-Sisi has been running Egypt since he seized power in military coup a year ago. Nothing suggests he's begun to alter his policies. The only thing that appears to have changed since his election, said Bloomberg News, is that he now wears a suit instead of a uniform, end quote. What el-Sisi had going for him was that he has become one of Israel's favorites. Not only did Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Shimon Peres send their warm greetings to el-Sisi following the questionable presidential election, but a year ago, Israel's ambassador to Cairo, Yaakov Amitai, hailed him as one of their own. According to Israel Radio, Amitai called Egyptian Agriculture Minister Ayman Abu Hadid to congratulate him on his new post and said, quote, el-Sisi is not a national hero for Egypt, but for all Jews in Israel and around the globe, end quote. This, as could be predicted, led to wide speculation on the internet that el-Sisi is in fact Jewish. Anyway, since the beginning of the Islamic State of the Levant's blitzkrieg through northern Iraq, Israel and its agents in the U.S. Congress have been warning the U.S. not to have anything to do with Iran, despite both countries sharing a common interest in preventing the ISIL jihadists from taking Baghdad. For the most part, however, Netanyahu and Israeli Jews have been preoccupied for the last 2 weeks with finding three Israeli teenagers who had the Israeli prime minister has accused Hamas of kidnapping near Hebron in the occupied Palestinian West Bank. While yet to produce any evidence to back up the claim, even when NPR Steve Inskeep asked him for it on Monday, Netanyahu has taken advantage of the situation to round up close to 400 Palestinians on the West Bank, accusing most of them of simply being members of Hamas. Although the comparison will and should be disturbing, Israel's actions, according to some observers, differ only in degree from the response of the German Wehrmacht to the killing or capture of a German soldier or military unit by partisans in occupied Europe during World War II, after which dozens of civilians will be rounded up and executed. The hundreds of Palestinians arrested won't be shot, but they will likely end up spending years in prison under what the Israelis term, quote-unquote, administrative detention, a mode of injustice requiring no trial that was used by the British against Jewish Zionists in pre-state Palestine and which the Israelis quickly adopted as their own tool of repression upon declaring statehood. While kicking in doors and ransacking homes in the middle of the night, Israeli soldiers have killed five Palestinians, including a 13-year-old boy, Mahmoud Doudin, whose life for most Israelis is not considered as valuable as one of their sons. Doudin died from bullet wounds directly into his chest. He was reportedly throwing stones. Given that Palestinian children like Doudin, younger than either of the three Israelis, are routinely arrested, imprisoned, and occasionally killed by Israeli soldiers, it might be considered the epitome of chutzpah when the mother of 16-year-old Naftali Frankel, one of the Israeli teens, went before the UN Human Rights Council yesterday in Geneva, asking for its help in finding her son and the two other missing Israelis. Much more can be done and should be done by everyone, Rachel Frankel told the council yesterday morning. I ask everyone to do whatever they can to bring back our boys, end quote. Frankel was joined by the mothers of the other two teens, Gilad Shar, 16, and Eyal Yifrak, 19, who were alleged to have been kidnapped as they returned home from school on June 12th. Frankel said every boy and girl deserves to come home to their families. It's unlikely she was including Palestinians. Yet a more outrageous example of hubris were the comments of an unnamed senior Israeli officer quoted in Israel's Ynet online yesterday. The Palestinians know that the IDF action currently underway in the West Bank targets Hamas and not them, he told Ynet. We are well within the boundaries of legitimate action in the eyes of the Palestinian public, said the officer, described by the paper as a high-ranking member of the Central Command. The Palestinian public understands that the kidnapping was an aberration, and our response was predictable. They know that we are not working against them, but rather against Hamas. The Palestinian public understands that a red line has been crossed. Well, only the Israelis apparently are allowed to have red lines or guns or kick in the doors of people's houses. The situation has led one Jewish U.S. senator to forget what country he represents. Richard Blumenthal, who replaced Joe Lieberman in Connecticut, believes it appropriate that Americans put out yellow ribbons until the Israeli teens are found or released. Quote from Blumenthal. Many Connecticut constituents have voiced their concern for the kidnapped students and are rallying together through the Yellow Ribbons for Our Boys campaign, wrote Blumenthal on his website. I hope our efforts, joined with so many others across America and the world, will let Israel know that it does not stand alone as it seeks the release of Gilad, Naftali, and Eyal. End quote. That's a U.S. senator speaking, but we know now which flag he salutes. What Blumenthal will not speak about, nor will any member of Congress, or for that matter, the president or the mainstream media, is Israel's possession of several hundred nuclear weapons, nor how Israel, back in 1968, managed to illegally divert a considerable amount of enriched uranium to Israel while no one was looking. Grant Smith, a frequent guest on Takes on the World, has uniquely been following this story and described the theft in his book, appropriately titled Divert, which I interviewed him about when it was published. Well, in April, Smith's allegations were confirmed in a press release issued by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and yesterday, Smith published an article on antiwar.com in which he cited, for further validation, a recent article in the Jerusalem Post by the Dean of Israeli Military and Espionage Reporters, Yossi Melman, that was only available online to readers who paid for it. Melman's piece critiques an article published in Newsweek online by Jeff Stein in May that exposed Israel's ongoing spying in the U.S. and claimed that this was the reason the State Department has been unwilling to allow Israelis to freely enter the United States without visas. Stein is a respected longtime intelligence writer for the Washington Post, but for Melman, the Israeli expert, he had gone too far. Melman insists that Israel has not done any spying on the U.S. since the arrest of Jonathan Pollard in 1985, and noted that Pollard was not handled by the Mossad, but by a special undercover organization designed to steal scientific secrets and materials named LACOM. In the late 50s and for almost 30 years, Israel espionage efforts were mainly directed at stealing U.S. military and nuclear know-how, wrote Melman. Some Israeli scientists visiting U.S. universities and sensitive laboratories, he continued, Israelis on business trips, military personnel on exchange programs, or working on joint projects with American security manufacturers, occasionally were asked by LACOM or IDF intelligence to obtain state-of-the-art technology and plans. In rare cases, Melman noted, some of the Israeli operations were exposed by the FBI and U.S. Customs. Israelis were expelled, equipment confiscated, complaints filed, but they usually managed to get away unpunished. This happened, wrote Melman, even with two most daring and outstanding operations targeting the U.S. nuclear sector. In the first case in the 60s, according to the U.S. documents, a joint LACOM-Mossad team, led by master spy Rafi Eitan, stole enriched uranium from a depot of the NUMEC company in Apollo, Pennsylvania, which was handling nuclear waste for the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. NUMEC's owner was Zalman Shapiro, an Orthodox Jew who later would be on the board of governors of the Israeli Intelligence Heritage Center. Eitan was also Jonathan Pollard's Israeli handler. Anyway, goes on Melman, an interagency inquiry task force set by the U.S. government suspected Israel was behind the thievery, but found no evidence to substantiate the allegation, end quote. That was from Yossi Melman writing in the Jerusalem Post. What Melman does not say was that, with the exception of the Pollard affair, there has been a long history of the FBI refusing to pursue instances of Israeli espionage against the United States, which has been documented by Grant Smith and found on his website, irmep.org. Well, finally, two pieces of good news, one on a related subject and the other right here at home. The first is that late Friday evening, after hours of at times emotional debate, the Presbyterian Church USA Biennial General Assembly approved by a 310 to 303 vote, a resolution calling on the church to divest its holdings in Caterpillar, Motorola Solutions, and Hewlett-Packard, three U.S. companies that provide equipment to the Israeli military to maintain its illegal occupation of the West Bank. A similar resolution was defeated narrowly at the last biennial in 2012. As expected from a Jewish establishment that is used to getting its own way with the Protestant churches, the response was not very friendly. The, quote, decision will undoubtedly have a devastating impact on relations between mainstream Jewish groups and the National Presbyterian Church USA, said Rabbi Steve Gutow, the president of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the umbrella body for Jewish public policy groups across the country, in a written statement. He should have stopped there, but he couldn't contain his contempt for the Presbyterians, finally having the courage to get beyond the guilt-tripping to which they long have been subjected by the Jewish establishment. So Gutel went on to add, quote, we hold the leadership of the PCUSA accountable for squandering countless opportunities not only to act responsibly to advance prospects for Middle East peace, but also to isolate and repudiate the radical prejudiced voices in their denomination, end quote. The reaction of Union of Reformed Judaism's president, Rabbi Rick Jacobs, was clearly one of desperation. In a personal appearance on Thursday, he invited the church's leadership to join him in making the case against West Bank settlements in a meeting this week with Netanyahu, as long as the resolution was rejected. The Presbyterians weren't buying it. The most vicious attack, however, came from Shmuley Botich from New Jersey, who has declared himself to be America's rabbi. In an article for the Jerusalem Post, widely circulated in the Jewish press and on the Internet, under the headline, quote, by condemning Israel, Presbyterians are condemning themselves, end quote, Botich described the Presbyterian Church as a, quote, unquote, rotting corpse. I have some news for Shmuley. There's something rotting all right, but it is not the Presbyterians. And finally, on Friday, those who have been long protesting the building of the Willits Bypass and have watched the area turn into a moonscape received unexpected good news. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had suspended the permit that had allowed construction work on the bypass that had wiped out the area's wetlands and streams, saying Caltrans was not complying with the terms of the permit. In a letter to Caltrans suspending that permit, the Corps said, quote, staff has repeatedly met and worked with Caltrans staff to bring the permit into compliance. These efforts have been largely unsuccessful in ensuring that Caltrans provides the compensatory mitigations required concurrent with wetland fill and impact, end quote. The message from Willits is, it isn't over until it's over.